With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. I'm Ben Eshmade, and this week we're delving into our archive, looking back to January 2019 and a conversation with actor, director, writer and perfume creator Richard E. Grant.
Every single person on the planet has experienced a friendship. The fact that these two go through all the vicissitudes of friendship, from loyalty to love to betrayal and then the poignancy of reconciliation, seems to be what people have responded to.
In Can You Ever Forgive Me, we find ourselves somewhere in the 1990s, following author Lee Israel, played by Melissa McCarthy, as she struggles with financial troubles, writer's block and alcoholism. She creates a false literary letter out of desperation and curiosity to pay her rent and feed her cat. As her journey into literary crime continues, she soon gets aided by sidekick Jack Hock, played by Richard E. Grant, who stumbles into a bar and into her life.
Last time I saw you, thank you, we were both pleasantly pissed at some horrible book party. Am I right?
It's slowly flooding back to me.
Did I buy you a drink? Even though you're the posh writer.
Thank you.
Craigie, top her up.
Grant, the swazzy English actor, made his name in 1987 with a drink-infused, instantly quotable film With Nail and I. He has not stopped working since, with just under 60 film roles to his name. To pick a few, LA Story, How to Get Ahead in Advertising, Jack and Sarah, Gosford Park. Who else has appeared in both Spice World and Star Wars? He also wrote and directed the 2005 film Wawa, loosely based on his own childhood. I met Richard E. Grant on the day he discovered he'd been Oscar-nominated for Best Supporting Role for this film. We do talk in passing about the ending of the film, so beware of spoilers if you haven't seen it yet. We began, though, with the Academy Award nomination.
I join you on what is a rather exciting day for you.
Yeah, never happened to me, never before or since. Never, certainly never been nominated for a BAFTA, let alone an Academy Award. So, yeah, Oscar, it's absolutely out-of-body, levitating experience for me. Yep. I'm not cynical or blasé about any of it. I'm absolutely thrilled.
Have you gotten here before? I mean, in the roles you've done previously?
No, I've never been nominated for anything. Wow. I was nominated Most Promising Newcomer in 1987 for With Nail and I. I was beaten by two young women, Jodie May, who won with Kristin Scott Thomas, and that was the last time.
And did you have any inkling with this film, which is rather delightful, that it was going to gain this kind of traction and this kind of effect?
No, absolutely none. It wasn't rocket science to work out that with Melissa McCarthy in it, it would get noticed or get some kind of critical traction because of it's such a departure from what, apart from the screen role that she played in St. Vincent, she is, you know, her larger-than-life comic persona has so predominated that I thought, well, whatever she does in this, it will get some attention, but none of us could have predicted the attention that it has got, least of all her.
You've played an incredible amount of roles on TV or film over the years. When you have a new project like this and a new film, what are you looking for? Do you know, or is it you looking for what you haven't seen before?
You hope that the film is about something, or that you're going to have a connection with the people that you're working with or the subject matter. And because it's capturing a kind of now gone, frayed of the edges, literary bohemia of the early 90s in Manhattan, and it's a true story, that immediately is attractive because you know that there's source material and the fact that it was all shot on location in the places and bars where all this these forgeries and this friendship between Lee Israel and Jack Hock, the character I play, took place, gives it a kind of veracity and authenticity that you hope that you're going to get in a movie, and that, you know, it doesn't come along very often, certainly not in my case.
And how did you become Jack Hock? I mean, the clothes were amazing.
Arjun, the costume designer, gave me all these Spandau ballet, you know, frayed at the edges, way past their sell-by date, last gasp of the singles bar, neo-romantic stuff on a very advanced middle-aged man 10 years after they were fashionable. So that was an enormous help and a key into how flamboyant this man saw himself. And I also requested that I could use a little stubby cigarette holder that is what Lee Israel had conceded that was a characteristic of how he carried himself off. So I thought that in combination with the clothing gave me a kind of steer into that he certainly had the street smarts and self-confidence to swashbuckle his way around Greenwich Village at that point in time.
You're friends with Julia
Steinberg?
Yeah.
She's not an agent anymore. She died.
She did? Jesus, that's young.
Maybe she didn't die. Maybe she just moved back to the suburbs. I was confused those two. No, that's right. She got married and had twins.
Better to have died.
Indeed.
And I read that you didn't meet or sort of discuss the role with Melissa until very near the actual filming.
Yeah, we met on Friday the 20th of January 2017, and we met for 2 hours and had lunch together and discussed everything with Mariel Heller, the director, present. And then we started shooting on Monday, the Monday. So there was practically no time.
Wow.
So it was... laugh with Melissa McCarthy. She is hilarious and heartbreaking by turn. She's incredibly emotionally present person. And there's no subterfuge or, you know, sophisticated game playing whatsoever. What you see is what you get. And, you know, I come from a small town in Southeast Africa. She grew up on a farm outside Chicago in Illinois. So, you know, there's some sensibility that we met in the middle and thought, yeah, well, kind of recognized something in each other that was, you know, has forged a proper friendship.
Obviously, the film rests on your two shoulders, but what did the director bring, or what did she bring out of you two?
She was incredibly open, collaborative, nurturing, and wore her authority very lightly. Having said that, you knew exactly who was in charge of everything. And she just, even though it was a very tight shoot of 26 days and a low budget, all shot on location with snow blizzards in New York at that time of the year, it never felt rushed or that you weren't able to fully, you know, give as much value and time to the scenes as you could. So, you know, that in itself is a talent. So I would work with her in a heartbeat. And she'd just done the Mr. Rogers biography starring Tom Hanks. So she's, you know, she's flying.
And for you, and maybe perhaps what you observed with Melissa, obviously because you've done so many roles, does she... have to do subtle things to sort of shift you out of your comfort zone or maybe make sure the comedy beat is correct or how she imagines it?
I don't really know how to answer that because you have all the dialogue and you rehearse a bit and you block out the scenes, you know, first thing in the morning, then they bring the crew in to see what you're doing. So I'm hopeless at intellectualizing anything. It's just completely instinctive and you do research you've come up with to what the scene is about, and you react off what the other person is giving you or not giving you. Okay. So I don't know whether that answers your question.
I think that's fair. It's like me, you know, if you do something for a living and me demanding that you tell me exactly how you do it, yeah. It's something you do every day.
I don't know how I do it. I know you learn the lines and you put the clothes on and you hope that something's going to combust when you work with another actor. What that is or how it happens is a complete mystery to me. I have no understanding of it, genuinely.
Lee, today was to have been the Esquire shoot with Spence. Difficult days, these. Thank you for your sympathy and understanding. Ever yours, Kate. P.S. Forgive the splotches. All tears lately. What a lovely apology. This is very special. Why would you part with it?
Clutter. You know, I'm not a very sentimental gal.
Handwritten, even. You're the Lee Israel?
Jesus, is there another one?
I've read your biographies.
Have you?
You're a wonderful writer.
Thank you. I want to remind my publisher.
Have you had much experience with literary letters, which is obviously the big theme of the film?
Yeah, I played George Orwell in Keep the Aspidistra Flying with Helena Bonham Carter about 20 years ago, and also played Anaïs Nin's American husband, Hugo, in Henry and June about her affair with Henry Miller. So those two films, there was an enormous amount of background reading of actual letters and books to be done. And that's always helpful and it informs what you do. You know, you hope that somehow by osmosis that's going to transmute, you know, through the words that you are given rather than what they had actually written.
This film kind of has interesting ideas in the sense of the character of Lee. She sort of falls into creating these letters, but she wouldn't succeed if there wasn't a demand for it. It's the demand that's the interesting thing.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether this corresponds with people no longer having religious faith in the West, certainly, in the way that they used to. But this desire that we have to invest literary or celebrity figures in any field with otherworldly or godlike qualities, you know, she's absolutely tapped into that. So autograph hunting market and literary letters, if somebody believes that these are the letters of Dorothy Parker undiscovered or Fanny Bryce or Noel Coward or Marlene Dietrich or Lillian Hellman, then I can see the appetite for that. You know, it doesn't, a day doesn't seem to go by where on Instagram there isn't a new Marilyn Monroe picture that has never been seen. I mean, it's hard to credit that Marilyn Monroe had enough time in the 36 years that she lived to be photographed that many times in that many different locations. But on a daily basis, there are new ones that come out. And they're obviously not fake, but I can see if you're a, you know, a mad aficionado of a certain literary figure, to have undiscovered witticisms and letters from them, because it's so different from an actual work where you, because a letter like a diary is the most intimate personal thing that you can have that person. So you feel that you have direct access to that personality, and she's absolutely tapped into that.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, I brought some wonderful Faulkners that I unearthed.
Not why I called. Listen, the FBI has been in here to see me.
The FBI?
They asked me to wear a wire. I'm not going to do that to you. I'm a good guy. And if they want me to be a witness, I'll lie. But you are going to pay me $5,000.
I don't have $5,000.
You're a clever woman. Figure it out.
I don't know if you have any letters, but I loved reading that you and Steve Martin in L.A. Story had a sort of conversations, or you kept all his faxes or something that he sent you.
Oh, I've been corresponding with him for 30 years. So what used to be faxes then transmuted into emails. So he has a thick's worth of correspondence between us over 30 years.
Lee Israel.
It's Jack Hawk.
When you kind of come into the story, it's quite nice because, I don't know, sometimes there's a big, long backstory or there's a kind of convoluted way in which you come in, but you walk into a bar, though it does turn out you had met each other before. But it's quite nice because you're both lost souls, you know, lost people that find each other perhaps at the right time.
Yeah, and I was very struck by two films that when I read the script and I was trying to find parallels of oddball buddy movies, albeit that Lee Israel is a woman. Neil Simon's play, The Odd Couple with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau, was an obvious example of two opposites somehow rubbing along together, and out of that, desperation sparks of comedy come out. And the other one was John Schlesinger's brilliant film, Midnight Cowboy, with Dustin Hoffman and John Voight, where you've got two very lonely losers living in Manhattan and who form this codependent friendship. And I thought that was a good steer into this, in that you've got people that, despite it being such a densely populated island on the planet and with such incredible wealth visible everywhere, you can be as destitute and lonely and isolated as if you were in the middle of the Sahara Desert. Mm. So the unlikely friendship that they form is something that people have responded to. Mm. And I suppose, whereas relationships that are based on marriage or blood relatives, every single person on the planet has experienced a friendship in one shape or another. So the fact that these two go through all the vicissitudes of friendship, from loyalty to love to betrayal, and then the poignancy of reconciliation, knowing that Jack Hawk is dying of AIDS, seems to be what people have responded to. Somebody who has lived his life as hedonistically and flagrantly as he has. He lives in the day for the day because it might be his last day. So I think in that circumstance, there's no room or time to waste on regret filled. You have to grab life while you still can. And I think that's what that's about.
And there's a lovely sort of wink in the script where your character sort of says that he could have made a great actor.
Clearly couldn't have made an actor at all because he was such a distinct personality. I think trying to get him to transmute into being anybody else would have been a very tall order. But, you know, he's a fantasist.
It's an obvious thing to say, but I kind of want to ask, do you see a parallel between this and the character that you played in With Nail and I?
Well, they're both alcoholic and both abject failures. But whereas Vivian Withner was so misanthropic and entitled and deluded about what talent he didn't have, whereas I think Jack Hawk is so Labrador-like in that he'll go up to anybody and lick them into submission for a bonk, bed, booze, whatever he can get out of the situation. He's a great opportunist. So he would befriend you, whereas I don't think Withner would have cleaned anybody's cat shit up. But this guy does because he, you know, there's something much more humane about him and far less selfish, albeit, you know, he's on the couch all the time.
Are there any roles that you haven't done yet? I mean, you've done so many.
I don't know. I'm too old to remember. I don't look back, so I only look forward. So, you know, like dobbing the old donkey with a carrot in front, whatever seems interesting or well-paid or working with stimulating or talented people, then, you know, that's where I go.
There's a nice tweet that you made today where you were sort of thanking the casting director who'd put you in touch for your role on Girls and for this as well. Are those people important along the journey for you as an actor?
Yeah, and it's to my astonishment and regret that casting directors, who are so crucial to every actor's career, are not honoured with a BAFTA category or an Academy category. And I just don't understand why that hasn't happened. I hope it does. Mm. Because when you see every department on a movie is honored with a category and casting is not. And, you know, the movies don't just get cast by themselves. They're cast by people who are absolutely brilliant at finding the right people. So, you know, I think that's an enormous unsung category. So honoring them and reminding of who those people are. I mean, Jen Easton in this case, and Mary Selway, who got me seen for Withnell and I, you know, 32 years ago. I'm absolutely wholly indebted to both of them.
And again, which you've talked about, is the fact that, you know, you're nominated for Best Supporting Actor for this film, but then why isn't the director nominated for Best Film? It doesn't make any sense.
You tell me. You know, there's something about Mariel Heller's style of direction that is self-effacing in the best possible sense, that in the same way that Lee Israel wrote biographies and didn't force her personality to the forefront, in much the same way Mariel Heller is not doing, this is a Mariel Heller production where you kind of see signature marks of a particular directorial style all over it. The powers that be that vote for Best Picture and Best Director think that two performances like Melissa and mine that have been, you know, honored and nominated and won so many prizes already, we didn't arrive at those in isolation or by ourselves. They were the direct result of Mariel Heller. But she is very kind and all forgiving and generous. And, you know, she's just directed the Mr. Rogers story. So, you know, she's all right.
And lastly, you're a fan of cinema. I mean, you not only generally enjoy it, and like today we're in the Barbican, but, you know, you're a cinema goer and a TV watcher.
I watch a huge amount of TV. Well, I grew up in a country where there was one cinema. So the movie used to play for, you know, pre-internet or video or DVD or whatever. It would play Monday to Wednesday, and then another feature would come Thursday to Saturday. So that was your chance to see it. You know, if you really liked the movie, you had to bunk off school and go and see it three times, because then it was gone, never to be seen again. And there was no television where I grew up in Swaziland. So it's been a sort of lifelong obsession. And I've used to get Films Illustrated and Photoplay magazine subscription and long to see half the things that never, ever reached where I grew up. So, and still go to the movies constantly and watch an enormous amount of TV. So, you know, I try and kid myself that it's for work, but I'm just a complete glutton for all of it. And I can't imagine that you've asked any actor that isn't interested in these things, or have you?
I'm not sure. Sometimes, you know, it's like people don't want to see themselves on the screen, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, but that's very different from watching other people.
Mm. Or they don't want to rip off someone else, I suppose.
Oh, right, that's never crossed my mind. You can't imitate anybody else. That way madness lies.
I thought this one line here was particularly clever, don't you think?
It's wonderful. I love his writing. And Dorothy Parker as well. Caustic wit, you know?
Caustic wit is my religion.
I can't carry it off. You certainly can.
Doesn't help too much in the relationship department.
I'm sure that's not true.
He was everything you hoped and expected him to be. Unfortunately, he didn't win the Best Supporting Oscar in 2018. That went to Mahershala Ali for Green Book, but I think it's just a matter of time before an Oscar makes its way onto his mantelpiece. I'm Ben Eshmade. Thanks for listening to this archive edition of Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. Here to inspire more people to discover and love the arts with weekly episodes of archive finds and theme series. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help us get the word out.